And welcome in to You're the Cure right here on AM 580 with Dr. Ben Edwards, MD. You're the Cure, of course, brought to you by VeritasMedical.com. Check out VeritasMedical.com for past archive programs and for other important information that pertains to your overall health. You can check it out there at VeritasMedical.com. Let me say good morning once again to Dr. Ben Edwards, MD. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Good morning, Wade. Doing good.
Hope you had a great weekend.
I did.
Good.
Down in Colorado City, giving a talk to a group down there.
Okay.
Been giving lots of talks lately.
I bet you have. I bet it's been a very interesting week with all the vaccine mandates and everything else going on at the federal level. I didn't, honestly, to be quite frank about all this, I never thought in a million years we would see something so dramatic that since the last time, because we were off because of Labor Day weekend, so it's been a while since you've been here on the show. But my goodness, boy, how things have changed in as little as 2 weeks, Dr. Edwards. 2 weeks.
Yeah, it is interesting, Wade. I've put off a guest that I was going to have today just to address this very thing, and to give some encouragement to people. We've had a lot of people kind of freaking out and getting scared and anxious and nervous, and we need to just remember the battle's not flesh and blood. It's spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly realms. So we've got to keep a spiritual perspective on this, I believe. If you're a believer, that's my encouragement to you. Keep a spiritual perspective, and the battle's already been won. But for the average person, and even not the above average person, we have some very well-informed and very educated patients in our clinic. And they ask really good questions. And I'm going to go through a bunch of those questions today and encourage my colleagues out there that may be tuning in to consider these questions and how would they answer these questions if their patients came in with the same questions. So it's going to be a lot of questions today and a lot of expert opinion. We're hearing lots of expert opinion. The general public is hearing a lot on mainstream media, but there are other experts that aren't getting on the mainstream media. We're going to quote from some of those experts today. And it's a battle of the expert opinion. And I want to remind my colleagues, evidence-based medicine, the pyramid of evidence-based medicine, there's some evidence that's considered to be superior, more weighty, more reliable. And there's some evidence that's less weighty, less reliable. Doesn't mean we don't listen to it, but we understand the potential for this certain evidence to be true is it's less likely. And that's, therefore, we say it's less weighty. So it's at the bottom of the list, the bottom of this pyramid. So at the very tip of the evidence-based pyramid is a meta-analysis. What a meta-analysis means is they look at a number of different randomized controlled trials, and they average those together. For instance, if there were, say, 30 or 40 randomized controlled trials about ivermectin, then they could look at all those randomized controlled trials, which is randomized controlled trials are considered the gold standard. But instead of just looking at one randomized controlled trial that might say, hey, there's a 90% reduction in hospitalization if you just do two puffs of generic budesonide, a very common inhaler that's in every single pharmacy in Lubbock and every hospital. You know, that would be one study, one randomized controlled study, and that'd be something to consider. But what if you had 2 or 3 or 5 or 10 or 20 or 30 or 40 randomized control trials? You can analyze all of them and average those together, and it's even more powerful. We call that a meta-analysis. That's at the top of the pyramid of evidence-based medicine. Randomized control trials are underneath that. Observational studies, cohort studies, case studies. And at the very bottom of that pyramid is expert opinion. So we need to remember that. Expert opinion is at the bottom of the evidence-based ladder pyramid list. Okay, news release. I wanted to preface that by having my colleagues remember this, that opinion is at the bottom. That includes the opinion of one man at the very top of the healthcare system right now, Dr. Anthony Fauci, and the head of the CDC, and the head of various organizations that happen to be doctors that I'm not sure they've even treated a COVID patient. So those are some expert opinions, but there's lots of other expert opinions out there. Here's a news release that was sent out this weekend. The American Board of Family Medicine, the American Board of Internal Medicine, and the American Board of Pediatrics has issued a joint statement reminding physicians of their responsibility to provide patients and the public with information that is factual, honest, and in keeping with evidence. This statement was prompted by concerns raised by diplomats and the public regarding COVID-19 disinformation. It is consistent with our commitment to professionalism as described in the ABFM's Guidelines for Professionalism, Licensure, and Personal Conduct. This also supports previously released statements from the Federation of State Medical Boards and other certifying boards. This issue has gained increasing attention in recent weeks, and the ABFM, along with the ABIM and the ABP and other boards, felt a commitment to take action against promulgation of disinformation that could be harmful to both individual and public health. And it goes on to, I'm not going to read the whole thing, it gets a little lengthy, but basically it goes on to say, remember, your license and your board certification could be at risk if you continue to spread misinformation. So, that was one statement. Here's another statement from the AMA. The American Medical Association, along with the American Pharmacists Association, the American Society of Health System Pharmacists, strongly oppose the ordering, prescribing, and dispensing of ivermectin to prevent or treat COVID-19 outside of a clinical trial. We are alarmed by reports that outpatient prescribing for and dispensing of ivermectin have increased 24-fold since before the pandemic and increased exponentially over the past few months. As such, we are calling for an immediate end to the prescribing, dispensing, and use of ivermectin for the prevention and treatment of COVID-19 outside of a clinical trial. In addition, we are urging physicians, pharmacists, and other prescribers, trusted healthcare professionals in their communities, to warn patients against the use of ivermectin outside FDA-approved indications and guidance. And it goes on from there.
By the way, the ivermectin that won a 2015 Nobel Medical Prize.
Yep.
I mean, the one that was, like, saved so many people.
Yeah, I'm going to quote from some experts here in a minute on ivermectin, including the Nobel Prize winner, who recently did a meta-analysis. He looked at all the randomized control trials. I'll quote from him in a minute.
Fantastic.
Because I want people to see and contrast these institutions versus independent physicians. You need to be discerning. I've talked a couple weeks ago. The truth cannot be proven with data. It must be discerned. When you have quote-unquote experts on one side, like this AMA bulletin that was put out, and then there's Nobel Prize winners, scientists, researchers, and probably most importantly, clinicians on the ground using early outpatient therapy. So we'll get into that in a minute. I have one more statement I want to read. So that first statement was the American boards. So these boards are institutions that certify board certification for doctors. Most doctors need board certification to qualify for hospital privileges and insurance plans and stuff like that. So that first statement was these boards of internal medicine, family practice, and pediatrics. And the second statement on ivermectin was the AMA. Now, listen to this. That just came out on the 12th. It's a little long, but it's important to hear this. Very important to hear this, especially for my colleagues out there. This is entitled Physician's Declaration, Global COVID Summit, Rome, Italy. International Alliance of Physicians and Medical Scientists, September 12th, 2021. This is a declaration that doctors can sign. We, the physicians of the world, united and loyal to the Hippocratic Oath, recognizing the profession of medicine as we know it, is at a crossroad. We are compelled to declare the following. Whereas it is our utmost responsibility and duty to uphold and restore the dignity, integrity, art, and science of medicine. Whereas there is an unprecedented assault on our ability to care for our patients. Whereas public policy has chosen to ignore fundamental concepts of science, health, and wellness, instead embracing a, quote, one-size-fits-all, quote, treatment strategy, which has led to more illness and death than the individualized, personalized approach to healthcare. Whereas physicians and other healthcare providers working on the front lines, utilizing their knowledge of epidemiology, pathophysiology, and pharmacology, are often first to identify new, potentially life-saving treatments. Whereas, physicians are increasingly being discouraged from engaging in open professional discourse and the exchange of ideas about new and emerging diseases, not only endangering the essence of the medical profession, but more importantly, more tragically, the lives of our patients. Whereas, thousands of physicians are being denied the right to provide treatment to their patients as a result of barriers put up by pharmacies, hospitals, and public health agencies, rendering the vast majority of healthcare providers helpless to protect their patients in the face of disease. Physicians are now advising their patients to simply go home, allowing the virus to incubate, and return when their disease worsens, resulting in hundreds of thousands of unnecessary patient deaths due to failure to treat. Whereas the above is not medicine, it is not care, we cannot sit idle while patients are forced to go home and sicken in place. These policies may actually constitute crimes against humanity. Now, therefore, it is resolved that the physician-patient relationship must be restored. The very heart of medicine is this relationship, which allows physicians to best understand their patients, their illness, to formulate treatments that give the best chance for success while the patient is in an active participant in their care. Be it resolved that the political intrusion into the practice of medicine and the physician-patient relationship must end. Physicians and all healthcare providers must have the freedom to practice the art and science of medicine without fear of retribution, censorship, slander, or disciplinary action to include possible loss of licensure and hospital privileges, loss of insurance contracts, and interference with government entities and organizations, which further prevent us from caring for patients in need. More than ever, the right and ability to exchange objective scientific findings with which further our understanding of disease must be protected. Be it resolved that physicians must defend their right to prescribe treatment, observing the tenet first, do no harm. Physicians shall not be restricted from prescribing safe and effective treatments. These restrictions continue to cause unnecessary sickness and death. The rights of patients, after being fully informed, and the risk and benefits of each option must be restored to receive these treatments. Be it resolved that we invite physicians of the world and all healthcare providers to join us in the noble cause as we endeavor to restore trust, integrity, and professionalism to the practice of medicine. And be it resolved that we invite the scientists of the world who are skilled in biomedical research and uphold the highest ethical and moral standards to insist on their ability to conduct and publish objective empirical research without fear of reprisal upon their careers, reputations, and livelihood. Be it resolved that we invite patients who believe in the importance of the physician-patient relationship and the ability to be active participants in their care to demand access to science-based medical care, in the witness whereof the undersigned has signed this declaration as of the date it was written. This is a declaration that just came out of Rome, Italy, the global COVID summit. And I just want to tell the listeners and patients, the patients out there, there is a group of doctors. It's a minority, but it's growing more every day. And we're in communication with each other, despite you not hearing about it on probably any corporate media source. But there are physicians on the front lines across the world who are gathering, who share data daily, share clinical experience daily, and make adjustments daily, weekly, monthly. And this conference in Rome is partly for that very thing, as well as to come up with strategies that will benefit the patient. I want to go back real quick. And here's the point. I just quoted a statement from the American Board of Family Medicine, Internal Medicine, Pediatrics, and then I quoted from the AMA. And now I'm quoting from just physicians, a group of physicians, motivated by, I believe, one thing. I know my motivation. And knowing these physicians over the past year and a half through various Zoom calls and phone calls and text messages and email chains, I think I know their heart also. And folks, this is where we're at, in my opinion. There's institutions that have stakeholders that are people other than the patient. The physicians who came up with this declaration and are signing it have a stakeholder, one stakeholder, and that's the patient that sits in front of them. I want to tell you a story about a doctor. Dr. Jean-Jacques Rajter, Rajter. You can go look this up yourself. This story was published on Channel 6 South Florida, April 13th, 2020. Not 21, 2020. So I'm going to summarize this story. Dr. Rajter had a patient, elderly lady. She had COVID. She was doing worse and worse and worse and was ready for the ventilator. He called the son and said, "Son, get up here and talk to your mom. I'm about to put her on the vent." The son came and said, "Doc, please don't do that. I'm fearful she won't come off the vent. There's got to be something else, anything. Please, I'm begging you, just look for anything you can find. I'm giving you permission. I'm not going to sue you. I'm not going to hold you liable or responsible. Just please, anything." So Dr. Rajter went back to the literature one more time to look and see if he could find anything. And what he found was one study, just one, not a randomized control trial, not a meta-analysis, one tiny little study from a laboratory petri dish where they had put some SARS-CoV-2 into a mouse kidney cell, some animal cell, and then they added ivermectin to it, and within 48 hours, it basically had stopped viral replication completely. That's considered not strong evidence in the medical world. It's not human. It's in a petri dish. The dosing, it's one cell. It's not a whole body. It's, how does the drug distribute in the human body and blah, blah, blah. There are tons of questions. So it's not a great study, but it was something. And when you weigh it against the risk versus benefit, because the risk of ivermectin is very, very small. It's safer than Tylenol. More people die from Tylenol every year. I think it's 400 to 500 people die from Tylenol every year than die from ivermectin, which I think it's less than one person a year on ivermectin. But long story short, he asked the son, do you want me to try it? And the son said yes, and the lady lived. Since that time, April 13th of 2020, you can go to C19ivermectin.com, and you can look at 113 published studies on ivermectin and COVID-19. 73 of those are peer-reviewed. 63 of those show positive results. And 31 of those are randomized controlled trials. On average, 72% improvement for early treatment. So my challenge to the AMA, who put that statement out last week, because my patients will ask me this, and have, doc, I read the AMA statement, but doc, I go to C19ivermectin.com, and I see 113 different studies, and the vast majority show benefit. Explain that to me, doc. Like I said, we have very smart patients. And then they go to flccc.net, and they see Dr. Paul Merrick, who's Endowed Professor of Medicine, Chief Division of Pulmonary and Critical Care Medicine, East Virginia Medical School, North Virginia, a leading published pulmonary critical care doctor in the world. He's known throughout his specialty. And he gathered up 10 other doctors from around the country and around the world who all told have published over 2,000 studies in their career. So these aren't just some Joe Schmo. These are academic, practicing, critical care physicians. And ivermectin's a keystone of their, it's a cornerstone of their protocol and has been for over a year. And then my patients will go and read news articles like on TrialSite News. Chairman of Tokyo Metropolitan Medical Association declares during this surge, the time for ivermectin is now. That's Dr. Haruo Ozaki, the president of the Tokyo Metropolitan Medical Association. And then there's a Nobel laureate. Wade, you were referring to the Nobel Prize.
Right.
It was a co-prize. The co-discoverer of ivermectin. So ivermectin did win the Nobel Prize, but so did Dr. Muru. And Dr. Muru stated back in March 11th of 21, the time for ivermectin for COVID-19 is now. And then there was a study. August 3rd, 2021, just a month ago, a little more than a month ago. Quote, and go, you can go look this up, New Microbes, New Infection is the name of the journal. Came out actually in September, but published online August 3rd. The name of the paper, ivermectin, a multifaceted drug of Nobel Prize honor distinction with indicated efficacy against a new global scourge, COVID-19. And from the article, it says, recently, Dr. Satoshi Imura, the Nobel co-laureate for the discovery of ivermectin, and colleagues conducted a comprehensive review of ivermectin clinical activity against COVID-19, concluding that the preponderance of the evidence demonstrated major reductions in mortality and morbidity. Our review of that evidence, updated with considerations of several new studies, supports the same conclusion. The primary lead author on this is Dr. Santin, S-A-N-T-I-N, again the title, ivermectin, a multifaceted drug of Nobel Prize honor distinction with indicated efficacy against a new global scourge. So you've got two camps. You've got the AMA saying there's no evidence, and then you have the Nobel Prize winner, along with his colleagues, saying, no, there's robust evidence, and then there's a review team of multiple doctors who published this study just last month that's saying we agree with that review analysis. And then you have the physicians on the ground. Dr. Pierre Corey, MD, critical care specialist, he put this out the other day. Attorney Ralph Larigio, which I've read about this attorney. He's from New York. Attorney Ralph Larigio has gone to court to force hospitals to give ivermectin to ventilated patients 12 times. He won court orders 11 out of 12 times. 9 of those patients are now home, and the 10th is rapidly improving on ivermectin. And Dr. Corey's statement at the end is, I guess this country needs more lawyers and less doctors. Could that be, that's a small sample size. That's just 11 patients. 9, and maybe it's 10 out of the 11 now are home. These aren't just sick COVID-positive patients. These aren't just sick COVID-positive hospitalized patients. These are sick COVID-positive hospitalized intubated in the ICU patients who most likely were many days into their ICU stay, because the court battle I was involved in, it was like day 15 or 16, and it took a week to get through all the court proceedings and all the back and forth and finally testify and then have the judge rule. It's probably 20-plus days into it. And I imagine these were probably similar, 1, 2, 3 weeks into it. And you have 9 already home and the 10th rapidly improving. Here's Dr. Tess Lowry. Dr. Lowry is an expert, a world-renowned expert, so much so that her company, the Evidence-Based Medicine Consultancy, this is a UK-based company, and guess who they contract with? The WHO contracts with the Evidence-Based Medicine Consultancy, led by world-renowned, highly respected Dr. Tess Lowry. Here's Dr. Lowry's conclusion after looking at all the data. It's an expert opinion, bottom of the pyramid. 60,000 died in the UK unnecessarily due to the blocking of ivermectin. That's Dr. Tess Lowry. So my question to the AMA, they have a right to their opinion. Every doctor does. And every person does too. The patient, I forgot to say this, what's on top of the pyramid? I said meta-analysis was at the top of the pyramid. What sits on top of that pyramid is the doctor-patient relationship, and in that relationship, who's the boss? The patient. I tell patients this every single day. You're the boss. You're hiring me. You're paying me your hard-earned money and taking time out of your day to come to my office to ask my opinion. You're getting a consultation with me, and you apparently respect my opinion and my authority and my expertise enough to pay me and ask me. And you know what I do? I give my patients my absolute best opinion that I would give my own wife, my own dad, mom, grandma, brother. And then I always say, consider this opinion along with any others. Get a second, get a third, get a fourth. A wise man gets much counsel, Scripture says. Go gather up your wise counsel. And then if you're a believer, you ultimately submit it to the Holy Spirit. And then you let peace be your barometer. And if fear is ever motivating or driving you or influencing you, I would encourage you to pause and pray about that and find peace. And I feel my heart goes out to the average person out there who is getting bombarded with information from one side, the AMA perspective on things. And they never even heard of Dr. Tess Lowry. Probably never heard of Dr. Pierre Corey, Dr. Paul Merrick, or the Nobel Prize winning doctor from Japan. Probably didn't see it on their nightly news that the Tokyo Medical Association just called for ivermectin use. Probably all they heard was the Poison Control Center has been overrun with horse dewormer overdoses, and some doctor out of Oklahoma saying the hospitals are overrun.
Which was a lie.
Which was an absolute lie. I don't watch mainstream news, so I don't know if that lie was corrected. If it was, it was probably very quietly and on the back page. It's fairly outrageous where we're at right now. And the reason I sit here and say all these things is because I have an oath to the patients. Because here's the bottom line question. What my colleagues will say is, the vaccine reduces hospitalizations and death. So there's the question right there. This is, to me, we'll go through after the break. Besides ivermectin, which I don't ever, when I have a sick patient comes in, vaccinated or unvaccinated, doesn't matter, which we have both. I talked to Richard Bartlett. He said the Regeneron, West Texas Regeneron Infusion Center, he was manning that. He's a physician. I've had him on the show. It's about 50-50. But anyways, we'll go through some of the other therapies, like budesonide that Dr. Bartlett talks about, with a 90% reduction in hospitalization. Multi-drug sequence therapy. We don't use just one drug on anybody. Ivermectin, budesonide, aspirin, depending on the severity, the risk factors, the individuality that the declaration called for, which, as far as I know, we've not had one person hospitalized yet, nor died. And I'll go through all my colleagues that have seen tens of thousands. Stella Manuel, 70,000 patients she's treated via telemedicine. Ben Marble's over 60,000 patients now. Dr. Amy Offit down in Marble Falls is close to 2,000 patients. Dr. Rich Dorso, same thing. Dr. Brian Proctor in McKinney. So we'll go through those. So there's this one side where there's a multi-drug regimen with randomized controlled trials, with meta-analysis, with a year and a half now of published data and clinical experience, and tens of thousands, probably hundreds of thousands now of patients in total. That's on one side, saying, hey, we can reduce hospitalizations and early death. Well proven. And then there's the other side saying, hey, we can do that too with the vaccine. So if both sides are telling the truth, then we got to go ask some secondary questions. Which one does it better? Or which one does it the most effectively? Which one's the most widely available, affordable? But that's probably way secondary. The real secondary question is, okay, at what cost? Not financial, because I think the vaccines are free. At what cost to the patient physically, to their health? Every medical intervention has a potential negative, including ivermectin, including the steroids. There's potential negative using steroid, including hydroxychloroquine, including aspirin, over-the-counter aspirin, which is part of the protocol. There's potential negatives to all those. What's the potential negative to the vaccine? If they're both effective, which one's most effective, and then which one has the most risk? These are simple questions. And granted, it's a fluid situation. This was a laboratory-derived, genetically altered, five different viruses manipulated and put together, funded by a man who's giving us instructions, which I don't know why he's not in jail now. That's another topic. But we're in a fluid situation with a genetically man-manipulated, altered virus that's deadly and awful and horrible. You can get sicker than the dog. I know. I understand this. I've had it. We treat patients all day. I'm on text all day long with urgent care and ICU and doctors around the world. It's a fluid situation with a genetically altered, man-altered bug. So the data can be fluid. Things can change. Obviously, as the mutations come, we knew. Iceland put out a study 3 months into this. There were like 280 different mutations 3 months into COVID, a year and a half ago. So now this Delta variant, and well, does the vaccine cover the Delta? Well, no, it doesn't. But could it still offer some benefit and reduce hospitalizations? And well, the people that have done it the most, you know, you can look at Israel and UK and Iceland. They're a few months ahead of us. And what's it doing there? And could it still offer protection? I mean, it's a fluid thing. But let's just say it does. The question is, which one does it best, and then what are the unintended consequences of each side? And there's the winner. You put both things in the balance, and one's going to balance out probably. And we'll talk about that when we get back. So we'll talk about the unintended negative consequences, if there are any, and that'll help tip the scale here. But then ultimately, at the very, very top of that pyramid of evidence-based medicine, that doctor-patient relationship, and ultimately it's the patient's decision, patient values. The definition of evidence-based medicine is, yes, you look at the best published literature, and then you consider clinical experience, and then you consider the patient values. And patient values trump clinical experience, and clinical experience trumps published data. That's the original Sackett et al. Definition of evidence-based medicine. So ultimately, it's the patient's choice. And to coerce, bribe, fearmonger, not only is it illegal to do that for an emergency authorized use, or even if it was an emergency authorized, which that's a different topic. Everybody got real confused when they came out and said, Pfizer's approved. No, it's not. It was extended by emergency use authorization. What was approved, it's not even available right now. That's a sideshow, though. But to coerce, force, manipulate, fearmonger, not only is it illegal to do this, it's immoral, unethical, It goes against every tenet of human decency and the doctor-patient relationship. All right. So when I was going to get to all the questions my very astute patients have for the AMA and the American Board of Family Medicine, we'll get to some of those questions. And a big one is going to be about what are the negative unintended consequences of the vaccine. So y'all stick with us. I'm Dr. Ben Edwards. You're the Cure. VeritasMedical.com is where we archive these shows. Go check them out. We'll be right back.
Welcome back into You're the Cure with Dr. Ben Edwards, MD. Check out VeritasMedical.com for archived shows and other important information to help you regain control of your health. Of course, You're the Cure brought to you by VeritasMedical.com. And let's get back to it, Dr. Ben Edwards.
Thank you, Wade. Before we get started, I want to make an announcement. There's going to be a peaceful rally for medical freedom and freedom of information. Hopefully we'll have time at the end of the show to get to the Trusted News Initiative and why 90% of the public out there doesn't know the things we're talking about here. And it is because of that good old Trusted News Initiative. But anyways, rally for medical freedom, freedom of information, September 18th, 10:30 a.m. to noon, Jan Jennings Park. That's at 82nd in Winston. You can go to healthfreedomlbk.com for more information. So y'all show up and peacefully let your voices be heard. All right, I talked about the doctor down in Florida, April of 2020. He went out on a limb in one little tiny study he looked at, and the patient lived. That is upholding your Hippocratic Oath, listening to your patient, the patient's family, and doing all you can do. There was another doctor who went out on a limb early last year, and his name is Dr. Zev Zelenko. And he's a family practitioner in New York. Maybe you've heard of him. If you don't listen to corporate media, you for sure have heard of him. And he, same thing. New York was getting hit hard. No one really knew what to do. He went to the literature, and he looked around. And what he found was chloroquine is a potent inhibitor of SARS coronavirus infection and spread. That's the name of the article. You can go to PubMed.gov, type that name in. Chloroquine is a potent inhibitor of SARS coronavirus infection and spread. This was from August of 2005. Published by the CDC. So, based off that one study, and that wasn't SARS-CoV-2, it was SARS-CoV-1. But Dr. Zelenko didn't have much else to do, so he tried. And it worked. So he went on to publish the Zelenko protocol. It's been out for over a year, as have the FLCCC ivermectin protocol over a year, as has Dr. Peter McCullough's multi-sequence drug therapy over a year. It's been published and out there, as has the budesonide that Dr. Richard Bartlett talks about for over a year. It's been out there. You can go to C19HCQ.com, 281 trials, over 4,500 scientists involved in these trials, over 400,000 patients involved in these trials. 44 of those are randomized controlled trials. So the doctors that did get out there on the front line and look at this emerging evidence and use their clinical judgment and talk to their patient and explain risk versus benefit of ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine and budesonide. Some of these doctors have published, including Dr. Brian Proctor and McKinney, a 75% reduction in death and 87% reduction in hospitalization with a multi-drug early ambulatory. The name of the article is Early Ambulatory Multidrug Therapy Reduces Hospitalization Death in High-Risk Patients. You can go look that up. It's on PubMed. Then there's Dr. Brian Tyson, All Valley Urgent Care. These are urgent care centers in El Centro, California. That's very Southern California, way down on the border, high-risk, metabolic syndrome-type patients, 6,200 treated with no deaths, treated early. And his definition early is within the first 7 days. Dr. Amy Offit, I mentioned earlier, she's at 1,542 patients treated. No deaths if treated early. One death in a patient who did not present until day 12 was told by her doctor to just go home. So she found Dr. Offit on day 12. Unfortunately, she did pass away. And then there's Dr. Richard Orso down in Houston, and he had a death of a 93-year-old who came in on day 8. So early treatment is key, guys, in the first 7 days. Dr. Ben Marble, I've had him on the show, myfreedoctor.com, telemedicine. I think he's over the 60,000 mark total. So he does prophylactic and sick patients. And last time I talked to him, 27,000 sick patients, 99.98% recovery rate. And there's plenty more. I won't go on. I'm just giving you an example of doctors on the front lines. Okay, we're going to talk about the potential unintended negative consequences of the injection. Before we get into the actual death and side effects that are reported, and then the analysis of the overall all-cause mortality that recently came out that shows the analysis conclusion was over 200,000 deaths from the vaccine. We'll get into that analysis opinion in a minute. First, the opinions of some pro-vaccine experts, virologists, inventors of vaccines. First one, Dr. Gert van den Bosch, formerly of GlaxoSmithKline Biologicals, Novartis Vaccines, and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation vaccine program known as Gavi. So obviously he's pro-vaccine and he develops vaccines. Here's a quote from, this is an expert opinion. Remember, this is the bottom of the pyramid. Quote, this type of prophylaxis vaccine is completely inappropriate and even highly dangerous when used in mass vaccination campaigns during a viral pandemic. Unless I am scientifically proven wrong, it is difficult to understand how current human interventions will prevent circulating variants from turning into a wild monster. There can be no doubt that continued mass vaccination campaigns will enable new, more infectious viral variants to become increasingly dominant and ultimately result in a dramatic incline in new cases despite enhanced vaccine coverage rates. There can be no doubt either that this situation will soon lead to complete resistance of circulating variants to the current vaccines. End quote. That was March of 2021. Dr. Gert van den Bosch, who develops vaccines, he said, don't do this. He said this early in March. Don't do this. If you do this, here's what's going to happen. You will force the virus to mutate into a more contagious strain, and it will lead to complete resistance. Think about antibiotic-resistant superbugs. He told us. He warned us. And now we see in Israel, who's highly vaccinated, I think 85-90% vaccinated or more, and we see they're at their highest caseload. Same in Gibraltar, 99% vaccinated, 2,200% increase in cases now. Continuing with Dr. Gert van den Bosch, quote, I'm anything but an anti-vaxxer. As a scientist, I do not usually appeal to any platform of this kind. He's talking about LinkedIn, which is where he had to go because no one would publish him or interview him. I usually do not appeal to any platform of this kind to make a stand on a vaccine-related topic. As a dedicated virologist and vaccine expert, I only make an exception when health authorities allow vaccines to be administered in ways that threaten public health. Most certainly when scientific evidence is being ignored. The present extremely critical situation forces me to spread this emergency call. So my colleagues on the other side will say, hey, there's some evidence that it could reduce hospitalization and death. And, of course, we talked about in the first half of the show, there's other things that will reduce hospitalizations and death very, very, very effectively. So those two things need to be debated. One of the potential downsides of going with the vaccine choice is it can have unintended consequences of creating a more virulent strain that's resistant to the vaccine. Turns out that's what's happened. Next expert, Michael Yaden, former VP of Pfizer. He's retired. He was a chief scientist at Pfizer. And he said on an interview, he's taken every vaccine he's ever been eligible for, minus this one. His kids have taken every vaccine they've ever been eligible for. His grandkids have taken every vaccine they've been eligible for. He helped develop the vaccines, and he's got a nice retirement account full of millions of dollars from making pharmaceuticals throughout his life. Quote, there's absolutely no need for vaccines to extinguish the pandemic. I've never heard such nonsense talk about vaccines. You do not vaccinate people who aren't at high risk from a disease. You also do not set about planning to vaccinate millions of fit and healthy people with a vaccine that hasn't been extensively tested on human subjects. End quote. Dr. Michael Yaden, former vice president of Pfizer. Here's Dr. Luc Montagnier, Nobel Prize winner virologist, and he discovered the HIV virus. Quote, it is an unacceptable mistake, scientific error, as well as medical error. The history books will show that because it is the vaccination that's creating the variants. Dr. Luc Montagnier, Nobel Prize winner, expert virologist, discovered HIV. I'm quoting opinions of experts. because we've been given opinions by other experts. And remember, these opinions are at the bottom of the evidence pyramid. But we need to hear them. This is part of robust debate, especially when lives are on the line. Dr. Robert Malone, the developer of the mRNA technology, June 24th, quote, "The government is not being transparent about the risk. I don't think the benefits outweigh the risk in this particular cohort," meaning the young. "But unfortunately, the risk-benefit analysis is not being done." That was June 24th. By August 5th, he said, quote, "The vaccine causes the virus to be more dangerous," end quote. And then he went on to say later in another interview, quote, "Stop the vaccine. It's a worst-case scenario," end quote. And the worst-case scenario he was talking about is antibody-dependent enhancement. This is what all these guys who are expert in vaccines and virology and immunology have been warning about and screaming about, and again, not being debated or talked about or discussed on corporate media or by public health authorities from any of the institutions I've been quoting from earlier. I haven't heard any of them address these serious questions. Antibody-dependent enhancement means you give a vaccine to a coronavirus. It causes that person to create an antibody. That antibody response is robust. There's a whole lot of antibodies. But then you go on to expose that patient later, some months or year down the road, to the native wild coronavirus again, and you get an exaggerated, out of balance, out of control immune response. And in the animal studies back in 2002 and on, when they were really pushing for a coronavirus vaccine after SARS-CoV-1, all those trials failed in the animal studies. Most of them all failed because of the significant adverse reactions and death. In some of the studies, it was 100% death rate of the animals due to the antibody-dependent enhancement. This is clear. This isn't misinformation. This is what happened. So when a patient comes to me and says, "Hey, doc, 20 years ago, there's this thing called antibody-dependent enhancement that shut down the coronavirus vaccine trials because all the animals died in one particular study. Hey, doc, did y'all figure that out yet? Hey, doc, can you show me those studies? Can you pull that?" Before I choose and make informed consent, I'd like to know, did those scientists publish some data that they figured that mechanism out? They figured out that antibody-dependent enhancement? Figured a way around it? Figured out a workaround? It's been 20 years, surely. Maybe they figured that out. Doc, show me those studies. My patients will ask me this. I can't show them those studies. They haven't been done. And this Dr. Robert Malone, who was a key person on inventing the mRNA, is saying he believes we're seeing the first signs of antibody-dependent enhancement. Please stop this vaccine rollout the way we are mandating it across the board. That's his opinion. And there's other opinions of these guys that are saying the same thing. And that was based off two studies that came out, and maybe some other things. I'm going to try to get Dr. Malone on to tell us his full opinion. But I know I heard him in one interview. Two studies came out in fully vaccinated nurses, one study in Vietnam. They were checking the viral load in their nose, and they were at 251 times the viral load in the vaccinated nurses. They carried more virus in their nose than the unvaccinated by 251-fold. Another study out of China, it was 1,000-fold more. So how could that be? What's what we're talking about with this antibody-dependent enhancement? You make this antibody from the vaccine that binds up part or covers up part of the spike protein, part of it, kind of enough to hide it from the rest of the immune system so the virus can just sit there and replicate, hidden, kind of like a Trojan horse, hidden inside that patient, until it gets to 1,000-fold more. If nurses knew this, that were vaccinated, they were carrying up to potentially 1,000 times more virus in their nose asymptomatically, they'd probably want to cover their nose, probably squirt some iodine up there. We'll talk about that in a minute. There was a study, 99.9% viral death with the iodine mixture squirted up the nose. The dentists do this in the mouth. I don't have time to read all the others, but Dr. Brian Brindle, y'all go look him up. He's a Canadian viral immunologist. He has a great quote out there. There's a Dr. Janice Lindsay. She's a managing director of Toxicology and Molecular Biology Support Services, LLC. They're all saying the same thing. Last one I'll quote, Dr. Peter Schirmacher, chief pathologist, University of Heidelberg. After performing autopsies on 40 people who died within 2 weeks of vaccination, he estimated 30 to 40% were due to the vaccine. And that quote, "The frequencies of fatal consequences of vaccinations are underestimated. That's Dr. Schirmacher's opinion based off his own personal data of 40 autopsies that 40% were directly related to the vaccine. The other 60%, he could not exclude the vaccine, but he couldn't conclude conclusively, so he kept it at the 40%. And he called for more studies to be done. Let's go do 200 autopsies, 1,000 autopsies. My colleagues around the world should do autopsies to confirm or not confirm what I have discovered. Okay. I know we got to wrap it up. Here's the number one biggest question that I need to be able to tell my patients, especially the low-risk ones like kids, people under 50. When they ask me, hey, doc, if I come in early on day 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 and get treated aggressively by multi-sequence therapy, what's my odds of going to the hospital? It's going to be very, very, very low. What are the side effects of these meds? Very, 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 very low. Budesonide, ivermectin, hydroxychloroquine. These are exceedingly low side effects. Doc, what's the side effects to the vaccine? Well, we're not sure. There has not been a data safety monitoring board during this experimental vaccine rollout. And normally there would be with all FDA approve studies like this. So we have to go to VAERS. VAERS has more death reported than all the other vaccines combined over the past 30 years. More adverse reactions. I don't have time to go through every single one, but I would encourage you to just go look, and I'll put it on my Telegram channel, Veritas Medical on Telegram. Download the app Telegram, go to Veritas Medical, and I put the data on there. I don't quote me on this, but something like 50 or 60 kids have gone deaf and 50 or 60 kids have gone blind. Dr. Jane Ruby reported this last week because the new VAERS data dump came out on Friday, and the adolescent deaths, I think, are at 30 now. And let me just say, every year, between 400 and 600 kids die from influenza every single year. Swine flu, H1N1 swine flu, 2009, 1,220 kids died in that pandemic. 385 kids have died from COVID in the last 18 months. And as every death is tragic, those deaths were in kids who had significant pre-existing conditions. Don't know if they were treated early with multi-drug sequence therapy. Probably not. But even that, it's less than the yearly flu death rate. It's way less than the swine flu. So if I had a parent ask for a child, what's the risk versus benefit? Well, there's not much risk from COVID. In fact, I read a study, teenage boys are six times more likely to go to the hospital from the vaccine side effect than they are from COVID itself. Dr. J. Bart Clausen, you can look up his study in Trends in Internal Medicine. U.S. COVID-19 vaccines proven to cause more harm than good based on pivotal clinical trial data analyzed using the proper scientific endpoint, all-cause mortality. That's the name of the study. Bart Clausen, Classen, MD. This was accepted for publication August 25th, 2021. What he's looking at is all-cause mortality. In the original data, the original six-month trial, when that Pfizer data got submitted to the FDA to get emergency authorization, the death rate, all-cause mortality, in the vaccinated group was higher than the unvaccinated group. I don't have a study in front of me, but so I'm going off memory. It was about 40 versus 25, I believe, all cause. So how many died from COVID, but how many died from other things, heart attacks, strokes, pulmonary embolism, or any, all cause. And so we already had a signal early on that all cause mortality was higher. Now, Clausen has looked at the current up-to-date adverse reactions, and he's concluded the same thing. All-cause mortality is greater. And then I would encourage people to go look up Steve Kirsch. Again, you can go on Telegram, Veritas Medical. I'll put this on there. Or you can just go to skirsch.io/vaccine-resources. That's S as in Steve, Kirsch, KIRSCH.io/vaccine-resources. And look at his presentation entitled, COVID Vaccines Have Killed Approximately 200,000 Americans. This is an opinion from an expert MIT statistician and his team of 20 other statisticians. And he's so confident in this very dramatic conclusion that he's invited anyone, AMA, CDC, FDA, anyone, to please come and show where his analysis is false. And it could be. Maybe there is someone who could show that. He's fully vaccinated, by the way. He's not an anti-vaxxer. He's got both COVID vaccines. He's obviously not anti-vax. But once he started seeing the VAERS data come out and the lack of reporting on it, he decided to take a deep dive into the data. And he does a two-hour presentation over the data. Could he be wrong? Possible. Could he be right? He seems to make a pretty good case. We can't bury this expert opinion just because it doesn't fit a narrative. If you're truly in it for the benefit of the patient, and you get into the literature and you see there are generic, cheap, affordable medications that have a beautiful track record of efficacy and safety, and then you have a new experimental device that doesn't have a great track record, doesn't have a track record at all because it's brand new, and the very early adverse event data is off the charts, and then you have analysis of these two different doctors saying more people are dying from the side effects than are dying in the hospital. At the very minimum, this needs to be robustly debated, and that's what I'm calling for. That's what I'm calling the AMA and the American Board of Family Medicine to answer all these other expert opinions and then let the patient-doctor relationship decide and weigh it out for the individual risk-benefit ratio. Okay. Last thing I'm going to say, and we'll talk about this more because we're out of time in another show. I'm concerned. This is just a personal thought and opinion, but I feel obligated to say it. The pride and the arrogance in the healthcare system. Pride comes before the fall. And I'm extremely concerned. If these expert opinion guys that antibody-dependent enhancement is happening, if they're right, then their prediction is it's going to get significantly worse in the coming months in the vaccinated. If they're right, let's debate it. Let's dive into it. Let's consider it. And if it's even a possibility, even a 10% possibility, it's going to be so devastating, we should plan for that. Public health officials, leaders in the community, authorities. The pride is so huge. We can't admit we were wrong anywhere along this whole 18-month deal. We can't go back and say, I'm sorry, guys, we were wrong. Please forgive me. There's been no repentance. And I had a little girl come see me. Her family brought her in. They're not patients of ours. They called me and said, please see my daughter. And I saw her to give my opinion. And the story was, this 13-year-old took the vaccine. And 48 hours later, she fell asleep. And it's been over 30 days now. And she's been asleep 22 out of 24 hours every single day for the past 30 days. And her doctor told her, it's not from the shot. And a team of experts at the local medical school gathered up and examined her and said, nope, it's not the shot. That's their opinion. I think it's a really, really bad opinion. And the devastation that's happening to these kids and other people. And we can't even say, I'm sorry. They had COVID prior to the shot. It's contraindicated, in my opinion. There's no benefit at all. Natural immunity is way better than vaccine immunity. So there's no benefit. If you've had COVID, you're good to go. Quit thinking about COVID. Go on with your life. Someone should have told her that you're at 3 to 4-fold increased risk of adverse reaction if you've recovered from COVID. There's 3 different papers that show this. I don't know if she's going to be permanently damaged or not. Nobody's talking about this. Nobody's admitting to it. Nobody's saying, I'm sorry. Pride comes before the fall. We need to prepare for a potential fall of this system. Wade, sorry I ran over.
No problem at all.
Medical Freedom. Freedom of Information Rally, September 18th, 10:30 to noon. Jan Jennings Park, 82nd Winston. We'll put this on our Telegram page too. Y'all go on Telegram, Veritas Medical. We put all the opinions on there that you're not going to hear on mainstream conventional sources. Wade, thanks for having us. Thanks for being a voice outlet for a voice.
Absolutely. Of course, you've been listening to Year of the Cure with Dr. Ben Edwards, MD. Check out VeritasMedical.com for archived shows and other important information to help you regain control of your health. VeritasMedical.com.